You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 28th of March 2023 on Monocle Radio.
America enacts its traditional post-school shooting rituals. Germany overcomes its reservations about sending tanks east. And which are the world's sweariest cities? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Nina Dos Santos and Robin Lustig will discuss all the day's big stories, and we'll have a preview of the next episode of our new travel series, The Concierge. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined today by Nina Dos Santos, international correspondent and former CNN Europe editor, and by the journalist and broadcaster Robin Lustig. Hello to you both.
Hi, Andrew.
Hello.
Nina, first of all, your first time here on the Daily. You are, as traditional for first-time Daily panelists, wearing the owl suit that we make everybody dress up in. But beyond that, introduce yourself, if you would. How did you get here?
I'm a 21-year career journalist. Largely a broadcaster on television, but I started out my career in print news. I've been a correspondent in places like Italy, covered all sorts of issues from financial meltdowns to terror attacks post 9/11, and also the ISIS attacks that we've seen in places like France and also Brussels as well. I was, as you said, the Europe editor at CNN for about 12 years up until quite recently. So I've had quite a sort of long career, got an opportunity to see many different stories and meet many different people along the way, which has been a privilege.
21 years, Robin, just starting out.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't want to sound too much like an old fogey, so I won't say any more.
But you are off on travels imminently, Robin. You are going on an artistic journey.
I am going on an artistic journey indeed. I mean, now that I have to pay for my own travel, no longer being gainfully employed, I do little trips rather than big trips. I'm going to Amsterdam to see a unique Vermeer exhibition. More Vermeer paintings in one place than have ever been assembled before and are ever likely to be assembled again. I'm a huge fan of his work. He only painted very few paintings.
Bone idol, frankly.
Absolutely. And very little is known about him. So I'm looking forward to that. One of the great joys of living in London these days is you can hop on a train and get off again in Amsterdam 3 or so hours later. It's just one of the easiest and most enjoyable ways to travel.
Well, we will ask you more about that upon your return. We've been doing a thing recently where we get guests to foreshadow where they're going, and then we talk about it once they've come back, and therefore we get two chunks of light introductory banter for the price of one.
I don't know why we didn't think of it earlier.
But we will start tonight's show proper in the United States, which is currently having the same conversation it always does every time a given mass shooting is either deadly or grotesque or unusual enough that it actually makes the news. Most don't. Monday's massacre at a primary school in Nashville, which killed 3 children and 3 adults, was the 125th mass shooting in the United States this year, and there have been 5 more since, the most recent outside a nightclub in Hyattsville, Maryland, which left 1 dead and 2 injured. Where the Nashville shooting is concerned, we have also had an amount of prurient speculation about the motives of the perpetrator who was shot dead at the scene by police. Nina, first of all, American media in particular, it literally cannot cover all of these things at a national level. Is there, do you think, an informally understood threshold of how awful something like this has to get before it now actually makes the news?
Well, I think there's a big recognition across America, isn't there, generally, that this can't go on. This is, as you said, not just the 129th mass shooting that we've seen in the United States so far in just the first few months of this year. It's also 2 years since gunshot wounds became the leading cause of death among children and teenagers in the United States, eclipsing road death accidents. That actually happened in 2020. So there's a bigger recognition that each time there's one of these mass shootings, yes, you're right, not all of them get the same coverage. And in this case, and I'm sure we'll get into this, there's also a lot of video coverage of this particular attacker, which is very arresting. the problem is that everybody will be watching from inside the United States, lots of people outside of the United States and countries like the UK where we are, where we enjoy the relative security of walking down the street, assuming that something like this is not going to happen because people are not allowed to get their hands on guns, let alone these automatic and semi-automatic assault rifles, which is what this, again, has been used to commit these attacks with. I think each time we sadly see these type of images and each time people around the world ask themselves, how come the world's foremost democracy, the biggest economy in the world, just can't get its act together to try and curb guns? And in particular, just put forward various background checks and things that seem simple that actually aren't particularly draconian if you're a European citizen. But I think in this case, what really passes the threshold is the fact that we do actually see a lot of CCTV imagery. That's been released by the police, and also body cam footage of the time when, of course, they confront this particular assailant. And maybe that might move the dial a bit.
Well, they are remarkably quick, Robin, to release that body cam footage on the occasion that the police have shown up and done the right thing rather than stood around doing nothing, as was the case in Uvalde, Texas. But that is something that has changed because technology now does enable us to see, well, pretty much everything much more intimately, up to and including, you know, the police response to a live shooter. Should that footage be released and broadcast, do you think? Does it actually further anybody's understanding of what occurred?
Well, you know, as a lifelong journalist, I am in favour of the principle that more information is good. I don't think any purpose is served by concealing information, particularly in an age where everybody has access to their own sources of information, whether it be on social media or elsewhere, and they will fill the gap. If official sources don't provide information, then others will. It's interesting how the police have handled this one, because I was just reading before I came in here, Andrew, a story suggesting that a friend of the assailant reported to police that she had had a phone call from the assailant just before the attack occurred, warning that something bad was going to happen and that she would read about it on the news after the assailant was dead. The friend reported this to the police, who behaved with extraordinary lack of urgency. First of all, told her to phone another number, then said somebody would visit her, which they did 5 hours later, long after the attack. The other thing I would say is this. Yes, of course, mass shootings have become commonplace in America, extraordinarily. But school shootings, particularly elementary school shootings, where the victims are 9 years old, three of them, are uniquely horrible and every parent's worst nightmare. That's why they get the coverage they do.
We do have a clip we're going to play because it does illustrate a pretty wretched Only in America moment. A woman called Ashby Beasley, who was a survivor of the Highland Park shooting, was in Nashville on vacation and was on her way to visit a friend who'd lost one of their children in another mass shooting. She had some words to say to the assembled press.
Aren't you guys tired of covering this? Aren't you guys tired of being here and having to cover all of these mass shootings? I'm from Highland Park, Illinois. My son and I survived a mass shooting over the summer. I am in Tennessee on a family vacation with my son, visiting my sister-in-law. I have been lobbying in D.C. since we survived a mass shooting in July. I have met with over 130 lawmakers. How is this still happening? How are our children still dying, and why are we failing them? Gun violence is the number one killer of children and teens. It has overtaken cars.
She makes some reasonable points there, Nina, but what have you made of how this has been reported and how events like this are reported? Are we learning anything about it? There's some suggestion, for example, that we should go out of our way not to mention the name of the perpetrator. But honestly, where America's concerned, there are so many of them that I'm not sure anyone remembers them anyway.
I think what's special about this particular case is, because, by the way, even after the Uvalde massacre at a school there in Texas last year when 19 children lost their lives, we do often hear the names of the perpetrators, particularly if they've been shot dead by the police in the middle of the attack. We hear their identities and see their identities distributed quite quickly. What's different about this case is that this appears to be not just a disgruntled former pupil of this educational institution, but also the fact that they are a trans person as well. And this is in a conservative part of America. I think that is why the identity of this particular individual is kind of an issue that's being discussed.
And has been the locus, inevitably, of an especially nasty culture war flap already. But there just to follow that point up, Robin, there's been a quote from the police saying that they're still unsure of the motives, which leads me to wonder, from both a police and journalistic perspective, if there is really any point in considering or investigating the motives, because it's not like we're going to learn anything that contextualizes something like this that makes any sense.
I'm not sure that's true, Andrew, actually. I think it is important to understand what drives people to commit appalling acts of this kind. And you just brought up the question of culture wars. I mean, to somebody like me, who lives a very, very long way from Tennessee, but was reading only recently about how there was action by parents' groups to ban drag queens from being anywhere close to their children because of the supposed potential danger that they pose to the children. Meanwhile, people are walking around openly carrying guns, and as we have just seen, walking into a school and killing children. I do just wonder about priorities in some parts of America and in some communities.
I think it could be that some stands are easier to take, like, for example, against drag queens, while others, like against guns, are actually complicated and difficult.
How complicated is it? I mean, I was looking at the figures today. The rate of deaths per 100,000 people by gunshot in America is 10 times that in the UK. It's not difficult to see the reason. The laws about owning and carrying guns in this country are vastly more severe than they are in the US.
Can I just make a point, though, also? It's that the rate of gun ownership in America is really big. 4 in 10 adults apparently live in a house with a gun. 3 in 10 adults actually own a gun. And obviously, if you're a Republican voter, you're far more likely to own a gun than a Democratic voter. But 31% of Democratic voters, Democrats, own guns themselves, presumably for fear of other people who have guns. And each time that you see one of these massacres, sadly, gun sales rise in America. I think part of the issue looking forward is obviously going to be the problem that the legislative bodies are kind of out of sync with what a lot of Americans want. The majority of Americans do actually want some sort of tighter gun control. They might not want to surrender their ability to bear arms, but they want tighter background checks and so on and so forth. But the reality is that would just get filibustered in the Senate, as we've seen so many times before.
Well, let's now look at Ukraine, the defences of which have been bolstered to the tune of 18 Leopard 2 tanks sent by Germany. This delivery is the endpoint of anguished will we, won't we, should we, shouldn't we on Germany's part, animated either by concern about escalating Western assistance to Ukraine past the point which Russia would find tolerable, or a certain residual squeamishness about sending German tanks east to fight Russians. Germany's reluctance initially prevented other operators of the German-built Leopards from sending their tanks, as Germany has to sign off on any such subletting. This is good news for Ukraine, Robin, obviously, and there's been a huge recent bolstering of its armoured resources. There's been 40 Marder infantry fighting vehicles from Germany, plus Challengers from the UK, Strikers and Cougars from the US. Does that suggest that we have collectively, by we, I mean the wider West, stopped caring what Russia thinks would be an unacceptable escalation?
No, I don't think it means that, but I do think it means that the lines are shifting somewhat. And as you were suggesting, what was thought to be a step too far 6 months ago is now regarded as an acceptable step to take. I think this is, as you said, Andrew, good news for Ukraine. Whether it is a game changer, I don't yet know. Everybody expects this spring to see a major upswing again in military activity, both from the Ukrainian armed forces and the Russians. And it's important for Ukraine to have the best weaponry available to them. A couple of dozen extra tanks isn't going to change the course of the war. It might change the course of certain battles in certain parts of the front line. And the fact that Ukraine does now have access to more seriously heavy and advanced modern military equipment will make a difference. How significant it's going to be, only time will tell.
I mean, that I think deals, Nina, with what Russia thinks. But I wonder what you think about the degree to which both sides are now keeping a very close eye on what the United States thinks. Have we got to the point where Russia's best chance is to ride this out to the next presidential election, hope the Republicans win, and that they basically get at least some of Ukraine served up to them?
Well, I was reading an interesting anecdote in The Guardian, I think it was, earlier today, quoting somebody who'd been at a dinner party with Dmitry Peskov, Vladimir Putin's spokesperson, who, when raising a toast during Russian New Year, said, look, it's going to be a tough year and we're in this for the long haul. So that indicates to me that, yes, Russia's strategy is likely going to be one of attrition, if you like. It can apparently afford to play that game at the moment, partly because it has its own army, but it also has Vladimir Putin's own personal army, if you like, in the form of these Wagner mercenary mm-hmm. groups. And in fact, just as we saw all this weaponry head over across the border to Ukraine, which, by the way, they were quite secretive about, understandably so. It seems as though some of these tanks arrived a number of days ago. We also saw big advertisements to join the Wagner group going up in suburbs of Moscow to try and recruit more fighters that apparently are being used, quote unquote, as cannon fodder. So sadly, I do think it is a battle of attrition at the moment. And of course, when the seasons change in March and April, and we do see this fighting on the Eastern Front with Ukraine pushing further with this weaponry on the ground, we're going to start to see later on in the summer probably more talk yet again to lobby for aircraft here. Zelensky's been very, very clear that he wants F-16s. Does that mean a future, eventually when this war is over, of permanent air bases that the United States or maybe the UK might be involved in on Ukrainian territory? The conversation might move to that later on this year, even if the war is still on.
Robin, on the subject of attrition, though, I mean, it's a fairly gruesome way to fight a war, obviously, but eventually you start to run out of things which you can attrit. And we can probably be a little bit sceptical of some of the estimates of Russian casualties put about by Western sources, which obviously do have a vested interest in flamming them up. But Russian deaths are now estimated north of 65,000, and that's to say nothing of injuries, those missing, those have run away, etc. Even if that is true, 65,000 give or take, that is already more than twice what they lost in Afghanistan and Chechnya combined. How long is something like that sustainable, even if we indulge that trope that Russia has an unusually large capacity for absorbing this kind of loss?
I think that's the most important question to ask, because what we're seeing and what I think Nina is right, what we're going to see is a war in which each side hopes that they can tolerate hurt more than the other side can. Each side is suffering grievously in this war. The question is which side can cope with
it. The Ukrainians are understandably cagey about their own casualties, which are doubtless considerable.
We know far less about their casualties. We do know that their infrastructure has been seriously hit by the Russians. Their economy, of course, has also been seriously hit. They've got a lot of outside help. Fine, that enables them to continue. The Russian calculation will be that Western patience begins to run out and that the current wave of military support that the Ukrainians are benefiting from will come to an end. The Ukrainian calculation is that, as you were saying, the kind of death toll that resulted in the Soviet army withdrawing from Afghanistan, the deaths there were on a lesser scale, as you say, than they have been in Ukraine, will result in the same sort of pressure. The Russians won't stop this war, I don't think, as long as Putin is in power. The question is, if and when he is removed from power, who will take his place? Will they want to stop the war or will they want to ramp it up? I don't think we should assume that the end of Putin means the end of the war.
Nina, just a final quick thought on this. You correctly point out that the next thing that the Ukrainians want is more advanced aircraft, whether it is the F-16 or, it has also been suggested, Sweden's arguably more versatile and easy to use Gripen. But do we get the sense, though, that the West, at least up until the next presidential election, the US is actually all in on this, that it has now been decided that Ukraine must win whatever it costs?
Well, I think this is something that you know, is at risk of turning maybe towards the end of this year as we head into the presidential election drumbeat, because obviously we don't yet know who the Republican candidate, for instance, is going to be. Ron DeSantis, Trump, they might have differing views on this, and they might change their views as we head into the campaign true and proper. For the moment, it appears to be holding up largely because also many foreign policy wonks will say, well, Ukraine must prevail because otherwise we'll have the Taiwan problem to deal with on the other end of the earth. So that is still the thinking for the moment. But you're right, it could get tested and patience could get tested later on in the year as we head towards 2024's election.
Well, let's now look at the United States. And it's arguably even sillier to generalise about the United States than about any other country. It contains multitudes, numerical, political, cultural and spiritual. Nevertheless, one would have assumed oneself to be on solid ground when characterising Americans in the main as a nation of ebullient flag wavers and indefatigable god-pesterers. But, according to a new poll for the Wall Street Journal, one would be increasingly in error. Back in 1998, 70% of those polled said patriotism was very important and 62% said much the same of religion. Today, those numbers are 38% and 39%. Robin, have the communists won?
Communists? What communists? I thought they disappeared a long time ago. No, but I do think this is actually quite interesting, and it is worth trying to work out what actually is changing in the United States. It seems to me that the fracturing of society is partly the explanation for those figures that you've just quoted. It's never been the case, I don't think, that the US was unitedly and as one man and woman a flag saluting, God-fearing nation. There were always many different
Indeed.
Kinds of Americans, but we tended outside America to see only those who are the most visible and the most newsworthy. That's probably the media's fault. But America is changing. It's partly to do with the changing media landscape. It's partly to do with the changing way in which society is organized. People move away from their hometowns. Children move away from their parents. Marriages end in divorce. So we are atomizing at a rate that we didn't used to. And all the traditional institutions, whether they be the nation or the church, lose some power and influence as a result.
Yeah, Nina, are you surprised by these results? I was. I mean, that is a huge tapering off in 25 years.
I'm going to be the contrarian. I'm not surprised at all when I saw this report. Partly because I sort of navigate the divide between generation, which one, Gen Z and Gen Y, or Gen Y and Gen Z. And I've seen how the economic prospects have changed enormously throughout the course of the millennial generation, for instance. And it is not surprising to me because I began my career at a time when the American dream, there was an acknowledgement that the American dream was failing and probably on life support and then eventually is more or less dead. And also, the America is a place where people are now very, very mobile. As you said, geographically mobile. They have to move for jobs. There isn't a welfare
state. But they've always been more inclined to do that than Europeans, though.
That's true. That's absolutely true. And we have the, if you like, the Uberization of society, as the French like to call it. This idea that while, you know, young people don't feel they've got as much of a stake in the economy. They don't feel they've got as much of a stake in their communities, so they don't feel like they will ever put down roots, and they won't aspire to have a big car, have a big house, live in suburbia and so on and so forth, be part of their community. I'm not surprised, actually. We were talking earlier on before coming on air here about how even places like the United Kingdom suffer this sort of generational disconnect, which also I think has a lot to do with economics. I've lived in other parts of Southern Europe as well, where young people find it very hard to make ends meet and take what their parents had as an economic prescription, if you like, and take it to the next level. I'm not surprised by this at all. I think inequality is at the heart of this as well. People feel they have less of a stake.
Robin, when you dig into these numbers a bit, unsurprisingly, and the thing that did completely unsurprise me, is that there is a generational split. The older people get, the more they tend to say that patriotism and religion are important. Is that likely to change with this generation, do you think? Will we, you know, is what we're looking at here just the normal trajectory of the older people get, the more conservative they become, the more they, you know, start to think about things like country and God and start to think they're important?
I really don't know what the answer to that is, because if you turn the clock back 50 or 60 years, you find that the people who are now the older generation were, in their youth, the Vietnam generation. Mm. They were out protesting against the Vietnam War. They were the hippies. They were the make love, not war generation. They were overturning their parents' traditional beliefs, their what they were grown up with as societal norms. So they were rebels in their youth. They now appear no longer to be, which is a source of great sadness to me. However, I don't know whether today's 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds will turn into 60-year-olds and 70-year-olds who do start saluting the flag. I sort of have my doubts.
Nina, what do you think? Because some of the things you mentioned are a function of economic inequality and some of the economic opportunities that have been available to previous generations, less so to younger people now. I mean, barring something extraordinary occurring, it's not going to become any easier to buy a house or somewhere to live in a lot of major Western cities. Is that part of what's driving this? And if that is part of what's driving this, is it possible that this change is a permanent one?
Well, I think people do feel disconnected, and I think it's going to eventually express itself politically in a lot of these countries. If, for instance, people who are 10, 15 years younger than me, and I know many who don't get a driver's license, they think there's no point. I can just call an Uber. I'm never going to be able to afford to drive a car. When I go on television and interview the CEOs of big German automakers, I put this point to them. I say, look, you know, there are some parts of the world where people really do aspire to own one of your luxury vehicles. But there's a lot of places in Western Europe, maybe even in the United States, big cities, where people just think there's no point in learning to drive yet. And as such, they're disconnected from that natural sort of chain of aspiration. And when I say aspiration, I also mean a feeling of belonging. Mm. Yes, that might be a material one, but it's still a similar sort of link to your community, you know, keeping up with the Joneses and so on and so forth. And they might not aspire to owning a house because they will be Airbnb-ing or digital nomads, couch surfing around Europe and so on and so forth. If that is the future, that's going to be quite... that will express itself in quite a big generational shift politically, I think, because obviously the political parties will have to take that into account, left and right, marketing themselves to this new type of electorate that feels it doesn't have a stake.
If they can persuade younger people to vote.
Indeed.
Well, we will turn now to something altogether more frivolous, specifically the vital research by the attention-seeking language learning platform Preply, or Preply. Not sure how. Preply seems more likely than Preply. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. I'll let listeners decide. It has identified, anyway, the most profane city in Italy, which has doubtless been a productive use of everybody's time and energy. The sweariest citizens of Italy are not, perhaps surprisingly, those of Rome or Naples, the driving habits of both of which would provide plentiful material. In third place was Genoa, in equal second Brescia and Padua, and in first place the citizens of Venice, though it is unclear how many of their average 19 expletives a day are uttered as a consequence of having fallen into a canal again. I don't know, Nina, have you found Venice, if you've been there, noticeably sweary? I have been there and didn't find it such, but then I don't speak Italian, so I wouldn't have been able to tell.
So both Robin and I have lived in Italy, actually, in Rome, which I would say I would have thought would have been one of the sweariest cities in Italy, not least because of the driving style, as you said.
I mean, I've only been to Rome once, but I do remember swearing a lot, mostly at motor scooter riders and pickpockets.
Yeah. I actually lived in Padua, which is the second sweariest city, in joint second alongside Brescia for 1 year, and I lived in Italy for 5 or 6 years at the start of my career. So I was really surprised by this. Venice may be a city of water, but I don't remember people speaking like a sewer. So I'm quite sceptical about this. And in fact, somebody in this article in the Times actually points out that Venetian dialect isn't very widely spoken. So it's quite rare to hear these types of swear words. Now, if you go to Naples or Sicily, or indeed some of the back streets of Rome, you hear really vibrant local dialects that are quite impenetrable. And that includes some pretty grand language. But I've never heard it in Venice, I must say.
I do wonder whether the explanation might be to do with Venice's historical role as a port city and whether the sailor tradition somehow gives rise to a love of salty language. I mean, if you think, for example, of a city like Liverpool in England or Marseille in France.
You're talking to someone who grew up in Sydney, Robin.
Well, OK. Is it true in Sydney? Swear at us in Sydney-ish.
Are you asking if Australians swear?
No, I think I know the answer to that.
It has been known to happen.
It has been known to happen. So I do wonder whether perhaps that is the explanation. I mean, the other thing specifically about Italy, as Nina says, most parts of Italy, people speak a language other than Italian, which is their own regional dialect. And that inevitably, because it's the nature of dialects, will have more, what's the right word, street language than literary language. It's not the language of Dante, which is what we think of as Italian, which is in many senses, an artificial language.
There's some pretty racy moments in Inferno, though.
There are racy moments. I'm not sure about racy language, though.
Can I point out, Dante's Divine Comedy was actually written in Volgare. It was a vulgar tongue. It was the first time that it was a text of that importance was not written in Latin. So it was written in sort of pig Italian, if you like, which was vulgare, which means vulgar.
Well, it did say...
Standards change.
It did say also in this research, and I will put it to you first, Nina, and I'm going to assume that you're both Italians for the purpose of this question, or at least honorary Italians. Oh. On average, Italian women swear 6.3 times a day. What would you say your number was?
Probably higher than that.
See, if you count swearing to yourself, that's got to be an undershoot, right? Robin, 11.6 times a day for Italian men.
Gosh.
Gosh doesn't count.
Gosh doesn't count. All right. One of the things that this article doesn't deal with at all is that a lot of Italian swearing is done by gesture rather than by vocabulary.
Outstanding point.
Not easy to demonstrate on radio, but nevertheless, I mean, you can be insulted more effectively by an Italian's hands and facial gestures than by any words he or she may use.
With all recognition of the futility of asking this question in a specifically audio medium, Robin, did you have a particular favourite Italian dismissive Italian manual gesture?
Yes, there is a finger under the chin gesture which indicates largely that you are not worth the space you occupy on this earth.
Nina?
Well, I was just mimicking that one. Yeah, I'd go for the same thing.
Or a
shrug of the hand when somebody passes you too quickly on a scooter and in the tiled cobbled streets of Rome, you sort of wave your arm up at them and yell afterwards.
I'm a big fan of the one footballers do when arguing with the referee, the little cupped hands forming a bowl in front of them as if begging for some morsel of mercy. Huge fan of that. It never works though, obviously. Nina Dos Santos and Robin Lustig, thank you both very much for joining us. Finally on today's show, Monocle 24's newest show, The Concierge, is our weekly take on travel by road, rail, air or water, plus the latest news from the industry. Before the latest episode airs at 1 p.m. London time tomorrow, here is an exclusive taster. Canada's Porter Airlines has been operating for 16 years, largely offering regional flights out of Toronto's Billy Bishop Airport. But they are now planning to expand across Canada with the help of a new fleet of Brazilian-built Embraer E195-E2 aircraft. Porter's president and CEO, Michael Deluce, told us more.
Porter recognized that customer satisfaction with the existing product was extremely high, higher than any other airline in North America. We consistently achieve an 85% customer satisfaction level, which is leaps and bounds above our competitors as well. Net promoter score, key indicator of satisfaction by customers in mid-55 range, which is more akin to a brand such as Apple. So Billy Bishop is one of the best located urban airports in the world. It's located about 3 kilometers away from King and Bay Street, which is sort of the heart of Canadians' financial district and entertainment district in Toronto. And it offers significant time savings and convenience for customers. It is a regional airport, though. And so the range of aircraft that can operate from Billy Bishop is limited to about 600 or 700 miles. Pearson Airport is the main airport serving Toronto. And that airport will really allow for the expansion with the longer range E195, E2 aircraft. Those aircraft fly 2,600 nautical miles, allow us to operate from Toronto, as far down to Barbados, San Francisco, really a much extended range. And E195, E2 as well will allow us to further double down on what we're already providing today. We'll continue to offer all the premium amenities, complimentary beer, wine, and glassware, premium snacks, but we'll be the first airline in Canada to also offer complimentary free fast streaming Wi-Fi to all of our passengers, regardless of fare type. And that is a first in Canada. And that is through a partnership with Viasat, where they have high speed onboard internet you could offer customers. It really will be as if you're in your living room surfing the web with full streaming capability. And on further flights, we're offering a selection of fresh, healthy, eco-packaged meals that really will set us apart from what is available today in the marketplace. And all of this is around an approach to elevate economy air travel for all customers and really bring enjoyment back to economy air travel, which has been long void from this industry for the last many decades as airlines have consistently chipped away at what they offer passengers and create this sort of two-tier environment where if you're flying a business class, super elite, or a premium passenger, you have a great experience, but economy, you know, is treated differently. The Porter experience will really elevate economy travel for everyone. The Canadian industry is primarily dominated by two large carriers, WestJet and Air Canada. Recently, there's been an emergence of ultra-low-cost carriers that have small footholds in various points in the country. Porter has always been the second largest carrier in Eastern Canada on the destinations we served. And so over the past 16 years, we've had a significant presence in Eastern Canada. And that was a presence that really was differentiated on the basis of service versus our competitors. Over the last 20 years, there's been a heavy drive within the North American airline space to reduce costs at all costs. That really did impact significantly the economy traveler. There's a bifurcation of travel experience for premium travelers versus everyone else. But 90% of travelers travel in economy, not business class. And it is a segment of the market that is widely dissatisfied with the existing products available on economy air travel. And we think that creates the opportunity to disrupt the entire economy segment of air travel, which is by far the largest portion of air travel in Canada and North America. We'll be delivering an enjoyable economy experience that people will pay a fair price for. It's something that comes at a premium, and it is possible. And we've showed that over the last 16 years. Economy air travel in narrow-body aircraft across North America is almost entirely in a 3x3 configuration. And so one-third of passengers have middle seats, and not many people enjoy the state of economy air travel today. If there are some, great, but no one likes a middle seat. I can say that with confidence. And the Porter product, which will run across North America, we will be the only airline in North America to not have middle seats on our entire fleet of aircraft. E195 E2 is an aircraft that is a 2x2 configuration throughout. And so Porter will have no middle seats, and that provides more space and comfort and really complements our elevated experience. And that really is made possible by the E195 E2 and its 2x2 layout.
Porter Airlines, Michael Deluce there. You can hear more from Michael and other news from the world of travel on The Concierge at 1 p.m. London time tomorrow. Available after that wherever superior podcasts are downloaded. That is all for this edition of The Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Nina Dos Santos and Robin Lustig. Today's show was produced by Lillian Fawcett and researched by Andre Nikolai Pamintuan. Our sound engineer was Sarah Nicol. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.